faith that is anonymous is of little use. And yet it has become something of a, I guess, a mantra on the part of some that all things spiritual are personal and never public. There is a withdrawing that is taking place within our culture where we pull back away from those around us and we're disconnecting. Some of it is being brought about through the advancement of technology, and it just becomes easier to do. And some of it is just, I mean, I don't know that anybody can point and say, this is why it's happening, or this is what caused it, or this is what the situation is, or this is how we reverse it. Honestly, I don't think you reverse it. I've talked to people who said, you know, we don't interact with our neighbors. That's true. But you also don't spend a lot of time out in the backyard or hanging out in the neighborhood like you did at one time. I mean, think back to the 60s and 70s and even before that, you know, what did you do? Well, we were outside. Why? Because you didn't have television. You have cable. There weren't, you know, 734 channels to choose from, which, by the way, 463 of those are shopping channels. As young as I am, and I think we all can agree I'm pretty young, no amen, nothing. I mean, it's just, gosh, he is deluded today. I've seen the invention of the computer, lived through that, personal computers, cell phones. I was telling the kids in college class one time, I had a bag phone. What was a bag phone? I don't want to talk about it anymore. So we've seen a lot of things that have changed and a lot of things that have come about. And you say, well, I long for a time when it was simpler. Well, I get that. But you really need to get over that because you can't change it. We can't roll back time. We can't undo what has been done. All we can do is deal with what's in front of us. All we can do is accept how we're going to cope and make the most of the time that we have. As a result of technology, as a result of cultural change, as a result of the speed at which life is being lived, the exchange of information, things of this nature, it has caused us to withdraw from one another to the degree that we have become disconnected. We've become more mobile. Even from the time we are very young now, we have a mobility that is unlike anything that we have known at any point in human history. And so we move freely about the planet, and we do so almost at will. We don't think about such things, the roadways and so forth. I was talking to some folks that had made the trip down to my mom and dad's when my mom died for the funeral, and we were talking about how it had changed over the years that we've been making that trip. It takes me an hour less now to get there than it did 25 years ago. And the only difference is the roadways, just because of improvements and the expansion and so forth. Things like that are changing. So we get around a lot better. We go a lot more often. This is just the reality, but the side effect of that is that we are no longer connected to one another. As a result of not being connected to one another, we live our lives in isolation even when we're at church. So we're all sitting in the same room, but we really don't have a clue what's going on in the lives of those around us. The bigger the church gets, the more that becomes a reality. I can't tell you how many times, there's probably not a week that goes by that someone who generally attends either 8:15 or 10:45 and has done so maybe for many years as a member of this church, may even be serving in a leadership role, will go to the other service. Heaven forbid. And people will say, visiting with us today? Now, that's not offensive. If you don't take offense to that. If you decide you're not going to go to 8:15, you're going to go to 10:45, and somebody doesn't recognize you or know you, don't take offense to that. That's just the reality of having two services. So we're disconnected. And yet when we look at the biblical record, we find that when Jesus wanted to change the world, he didn't start a program, he didn't use the technology of the day, he wasn't dependent on roadways and mobility, things of this nature that are so much a part of our lives today. But rather, when he wanted to change the world, he didn't do a big ad campaign, he didn't use some sort of quick method in order to disperse the information that he wanted to communicate. He gathered a really small group of people, unlikely people together, and then he spent every waking moment pouring his life into them. They lived with him 24/7, and during that time he discipled them so that they became known as disciples. Discipleship is one of the most elusive things in church life these days. Discipleship is hard to come by. It is a level of spiritual growth and maturity that takes place in the life of a believer, but generally not as a result of the believer's initiative alone. It usually requires leadership, and it usually requires someone else with a greater degree of maturity or experience or expertise to pour that into the life of someone else. The way we do that is we do it through worship services like this, where you listen to things like I'm sharing with you now. We do it in our small groups, where we gather together on Sunday morning and we share prayer requests and needs and so forth, and then we study the Bible together. And we do it in some of our specialty studies as well. But even then, we're talking about a very, very small window of time, and that isn't discipleship, that's teaching. That isn't pouring into someone, that's communicating with someone. And discipleship requires a more intimate level of exchange. It requires a more intimate level of connection so that the relationships that you connect with here and those that you already have outside of your spiritual experience or family, those relationships, as they grow, become the means by which you pour your life and Christ that is in you into that of another. Now, along the way, in order for this to work, there's some things that need to be present. We need to have certain things that are going to be a part of that process. It goes without saying, I would hope, that discipling someone who isn't a believer is futile. At that point, you're not discipling them, you're witnessing to them. And so a person who is not a believer, a person who has not accepted Christ and committed their lives to following him, is a person that we're trying to reach for the sake of Christ with the gospel rather than discipleship. Discipleship takes place after. So discipleship is for believers. Discipleship generally takes place within the context of the church. And so the church itself, the church family, the church experience, the things that we do together, we aren't just joining together to accomplish tasks or to fulfill a purpose that has a to-do list associated with it. We are here developing lives. We are here pouring into the lives of others as well as others pouring their lives into us. All of that is working together to transform. Out of that comes something else. In order for this to work, there has to be a certain degree of transparency and trust. That means that the church family has to be a place of safety, and it isn't always. Baptists have often been known for shooting their wounded rather than healing them. We're in a world today where we are so conflicted that we want everyone to know Jesus and we want them to come to salvation, but we are so terrified of some of the things that are going on in the world around us that we don't even know where to begin or how to connect with that. And I understand. I share that as well. I'm not telling you something as a condemnation of any one of us. I'm saying this is just how it is. All of these things then drive us away from one another. It has to be a place of transparency, a place of trust, and a place where we are courageous to confront the things that otherwise are damaging to an individual, to a family, or a community. This is not just to make the world a better place to live. This is to make us people that reveal Christ, so that as we grow in this spiritual experience with Him, in maturity and in knowledge and understanding, we become better equipped to now become disciplers ourselves. You say, well, who has the time? I don't know. Not me. Who has the time? Well, let me tell you something. We all have exactly the same amount of time. Everybody. And I want you to know that the amount of time that you have is exactly the same as the amount of time that people had in 1945. Nothing's changed. What has changed is how we use the time and what we fill the time with, and the availability of things that make us feel like we not only have the right to have all of these choices and options and selections and so forth, but it also is something that we expect. So then we constantly are filling every moment of our lives, leaving no margin for other things like these kinds of relationships. It's a tough thing. Now, I'm not telling you something you don't know. I'm telling you that what we're finding is that the church has developed in the last, I don't know, probably 100 years, but certainly in the last 50 to 75 years, the evangelical community has developed in a way where we have focused our attention on simply getting people to say a prayer of salvation, to be baptized, to join a church. And then if they come, fine, and if they don't, that's fine. But really no effort at discipleship has been made. In fact, everything that we are doing is kind of moving us away from that. As a result, what we are finding is a Christian community that is extremely divided, because there's no agreement on theology, there's no agreement on doctrine, there's no agreement on the Bible and how to understand what God has said to us. There's no agreement on commitment. In fact, we dismiss scriptural authority without even a blink of an eye if it's going to run counter to something that we want to do. And because we're not really connected to one another, there's no one to suggest otherwise. Yeah, the preacher says stuff like that, but that's what they're supposed to do. We can ignore him too. So along the way, seeing all of this and understanding all of this, one of the things that the pastors and leadership of Temple Baptist Church, and I speak of myself now in the third party, wanted to do was to try to help us find ways that we can connect small groups, their expansion, their development, discipleship classes, meeting at all kinds of different times. I'd mentioned the Wednesday morning men's Bible study, and that is a class. That's a discipleship group. We're building relationships there. Last Wednesday, we had 61 guys there. It was our largest attendance ever. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, where does it go from here? I don't know. I don't see it slowing down. In fact, if anything, I see now it's going to start to pick up, and it may have some sort of exponential growth, and I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know where we're going to put them all. But I know this, we're going to find a place. And that place has to have a really, really good coffee machine. And a table that can support about 100 pounds of donuts. Which means that the chairs they sit in are going to have to be pretty strong too over a course of time, because they're going to get more weight on them as well. It's a great opportunity. These are things like this. We've got to build these kinds of opportunities into the schedules that we have, into the lives that we are living, sacrificing one thing, whether it's sleep in the case of Wednesday morning, or whether it's something else, in order to be able to spend time with one another, focusing our attention on those things that allow us to do life together so that we can expand that. We started looking for all these different ways, moving outside traditional models and time frames and schedules and things like that, to meet people where they are and where they were available in order to build opportunities for these kinds of experiences. Discipleship is vitally important. If we do not train and teach, and we do not share and do life together, and we do not practice, fail, and succeed, and I mean all the above, we will not learn how to grow in Christ. Discipleship is essential. Along the way, we need accountability in order for this to happen. You may not know it, but this year is an anniversary year for Temple Baptist Church. 2017, in September of 2017, Temple Baptist Church will be 90 years old. Now, that's a pretty significant thing. In 1927, a group of people gathered together in order to form a church. They met first in a home, then in a borrowed hall, and then in a basement made of stones. And they did that over the course of time. And the one thing that was consistent throughout, from the formation of that small group of believers who wanted to serve God and to share the gospel and to support others who would, from that formation, one thing is consistent. Each of the developmental periods of Temple Baptist Church was guided by something called a church covenant. It got changed along the way and altered, and things were added and some were taken away or worded differently. But we've always had a church covenant. I remember when we were talking about membership covenant back when we were going through the rewriting of our constitution and bylaws, there was someone who said that there are no other covenants that we make, and yet we make covenants all the time. It's as much a part of common everyday experiences as it just about anything else, and we just don't realize it. A covenant is a lot of different things that we're going to talk about in just a moment, but one of the things that we find that is consistent throughout is that down through the ages, all believers and followers of God have had something that calls them to account and helps them to hold one another accountable for that which God expects of us, knowing that our inclination is to do the opposite. Discipleship, togetherness in the church, is absolutely essential to provide for us a family environment in which, like your nuclear family, is going to help you learn and grow and fail and be loved anyway and picked up and helped and forgiven and fail again and then do it all over and keep doing that until you finally start perpetuating that on your own. The church should be no different. Covenants have always guided that process and have always been a part of the history of this church, as well as just about every other Christian group. So what's the big deal with it? When we started writing our membership covenant, I got to tell you, I didn't really, it was hard. But we got it done, and it was a part of that, and I've taught it in 101. Craig keeps coming around saying, you know, we need to redo this. I said, nah, we don't need to redo it. Well, it's just not quite where it needs to be. It's not what I wanted it to be. It didn't seem to have the impact, and people misunderstood, and this sort of thing and that. Ah, leave me alone. I don't want to do it anymore. So when we decided that we were going to do this series in January on the primary purpose and vision of the church, and then 2 weeks on the church covenant, and I'm teaching, in fact, I just finished last Wednesday night teaching in 101 membership covenant to that group of folks, I started to see what he was talking about. Yeah, it does need some work. So even if I tell you that our membership covenant is needed, what I'm also telling you is that in 2017, it's probably going to change. But what's not going to change are the principles that guide it. The problem with these covenants is we get so detailed and we start making lists and it becomes more legalistic and it becomes more rule-oriented. And that wasn't ever the intent. The intent was that it would provide a statement that would help us to understand the expectations biblically that God has for every believer and the necessity of us working together with one another to have any hope of living according to such principles. Realizing that to the degree that we live the principles of God in front of the world around us, we become an extension and an expression of faith in a world that is lost. And when we don't, we become a stumbling stone of confusion and misunderstanding for that same lost world. Some of these things are really easy to see. Professional athletic teams write moral clauses into their contracts with players. When players falter outside the game and bring disrepute on the team or bring a negative impact on the team, they can be removed from the team or let go because they are breaching their moral contract. I'm deeply indebted to Matt Schmucker. Matt is a teaching pastor now in Anacostia, District Columbia, Anacostia Church. But he was the founder and executive director for something called Nine Marks Ministries. Nine Marks came from Mark Dever, who was pastor of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., and had the chance to get to know Mark, serving on the board of trustees with him at Southern Seminary over the course of a few years. His ministry to churches has expanded now, and Nine Marks Ministries has helped thousands and thousands of churches to better identify their biblical role and purpose and how to live that out, and we rely pretty heavily on some of their information. Matt, as the founder and executive director of that, wrote an article regarding this very issue of church covenants or membership covenants, and I'm relying a lot on his article. So I'm telling you that I'm kind of ripping that thing off left and right in order to share this message. Up to now, it's just been all me. But that's just introductory. Now it's going to be mostly him. In the 1980s, IBM had a detailed dress code in which they required all their salesmen to adhere. Dark suit, white shirt, dark tie. Why? They wanted everyone to know when they saw that particular uniform walk into the office building that this was an IBM sales rep, this was an IBM employee, and they were all going to look the same. They were all going to have the sort of same demeanor about them, and there was going to be a consistency that would give a measure of comfort to anyone doing business with IBM. It worked, and it became identifiable, and it was something that they recognized. The organization knew that every time a representative went into one of the businesses of a community, they were representing the corporation, and they wanted to be sure that the image that was being presented would be one of the highest reputation and excellence in the public eye. Should the church do any less? These two examples underscore the importance of who we say we are, who we identify with, how the public message and identification relate to the ways in which we actually live. In other words, what you say needs to match what you do. James warns, if anyone considers himself religious and yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. Worthless. Now, what does this mean? If you profess to be a Christian, but you do not live a changed life, you should take no comfort in your faith. That's a strong statement. If you claim to be a Christian, but there is no evidence of faith in your life, how can you find comfort in that or peace? Why do we need a membership covenant? Why do we need a church covenant? Could we do this without it? We could, but we won't. Could we not pass this on verbally? Can we not just agree that the Bible is going to be sufficient? We could, but it isn't. Why? Because we don't read it, because we don't teach it, because we're not consistent and faithful to the way we live it. Is this going to solve the problem? It isn't. But at least it's a step forward. One of the things that we wanted to do when we wrote the church covenant and the membership covenant was to try and have an opportunity to communicate that on a regular basis, to at least do so on an annual basis. But there was a misunderstanding that took place within the church family that I've not been able to overcome. I've explained it a number of times, but I'm not sure that people hear me when I say it. People looked at that and they immediately thought that it was being used as some sort of standard or judge or rule in order to eliminate people from the church. That has never been the case. In fact, the very opposite of that is the truth. The membership covenant was not intended to eliminate people. It was intended in order to provide a means to help to redeem and restore and guide us together. In fact, over and over we say in the membership covenant that these things are not there so that somebody can stand me or anyone else and say, well, you're in violation of the membership covenant. You need to change or get out. That's just so inconsistent with the whole concept of grace and forgiveness and surrender and the very idea that anyone, pastor or otherwise, would be so arrogant to put themselves in a position of judge, jury, and executioner for the sake of lording it over someone else is absolutely insane. Yet we do it all the time. Why is it insane? Because every single person in this room is a sinner. Every single one of us messed up yesterday for sure. And the only reason you wouldn't have today is because you still haven't quite woken up. But as soon as you get that first win, you're going to mess up. Well, no, I'm not. Well, now you've just messed up because you deceived yourself, lied to yourself, and to everybody else. Well, how'd I mess up? Well, you acted a fool because you have no humility. Don't you see? The membership covenant was never intended to be that kind of instrument. It was intended to be a means of celebrating and encouraging us together, so that we grow in our faith and we mature in our understanding. But we have to recognize that without a consistent life, apart from the words that we speak to support those words, then what we're going to have is just hypocrisy. And it's not genuine faith. 1 John 2:3 says, we know we have come to know Him if we obey His commands. It's really not difficult. You say, well, that's convicting. It's supposed to be convicting, but it's not condemning. And there's a difference. So what is a church covenant? Let's talk about that a little bit. Several things. First of all, church covenant is a promise. It's a promise made to God. It's a promise made to a local congregation. It's a promise made to oneself. A church covenant is always a promise. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that it's a contractual arrangement? If you violate it, that you're going to be somehow kicked out? Well, I'm not going to say no, that it never ever means that, because there are some instances where it could mean that. But it's one of those things where we're making a promise in the sense that we're wanting to see meaningful change. We are wanting to be a part of a covenant community. We are wanting to participate, recognizing that we have a role as well as everybody else, and that we are working together for a common purpose that is to glorify God. And so a church covenant is a promise. There's no getting away from that. When we enter into membership within the church, it makes a difference. It means something. A church covenant is, secondly, a summary of how we agree to live. It's not a detailed description. It's just a general statement or summary. Our statement of faith is a good summary of what we believe. A church covenant is a summary of what we're going to do with and because of what we believe. You say, well, I don't want to do anything with that. Well, one of the reasons that we don't want to do anything is because we're not sure what we believe. Or the things that we claim to believe, we haven't really given careful consideration to, and so we've not also considered the implications that that has ethically on our lives. Our church covenant is a summary of how we agree to live. It is a summary of how God would have us to live. It does not include every explicit command that is going to be given regarding that, but it does include that general statement as a means of helping us guide our lives. Church covenant is a sign of commitment, a commitment to God, to His church, and to personal holiness. Commitment to each other, commitment to God, a commitment to yourself to live the life that Christ has set before you. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, there's everything that is right with that. A church covenant is an ethical statement. Historian Charles DeWeese says a church covenant is a series of written pledges based on the Bible which church members voluntarily make to God, to one another, regarding their basic moral and spiritual commitments in the practice of their faith. One theologian calls church covenants the ethical counterpart to confessions of faith. We subscribe to the Baptist Faith and Message, which is a confession of faith, and our own articles of faith, both of which are doctrinal statements about what we believe. What we're talking about in a church covenant is how that belief transforms our lives and how it governs how we act. A church covenant is a biblical standard. A church covenant is helpful in a church that is practicing biblical truth and biblical discipline. And so if the covenant itself is biblical, and we ourselves want to be biblical, and we want to help one another be biblical, then the church covenant should suffice to help guide all of that. Now, it brings up the issue of discipline, biblical discipline. And I think once in a while we hear that and we just sort of cringe because it has such a, strict, almost legalistic sound to it. You wait till your father gets home. He's going to discipline you. That's what we think. Now, a better way to say that would wait till your father gets home. He's going to beat you senseless. I mean, that's another way to say it. But that's regardless of what your experience has been. Because when my dad would come home, it was always the same routine. First was the lecture, which, by the way, was endless and far worse than the spanking. I would have gladly added additional licks to the spanking to have just avoided the lecture. I even suggested that one time. The lecture took twice as long and I got additional stripes. Just really didn't work out for me at all. So, you just had to take it. So you'd come home, you'd have the lecture, then you'd get the spanking, and then you'd have to go to your room and think about what you've done. And so you go to your room, and what do you think about? You think about how you got caught and how to avoid that the next time. And so that sort of discipline, but did it have an effect? Yes, it did. It really did. At the end of the process of sitting in the room on the bed was the final conclusion. This is the worst part of the whole thing. Mom would come in. She'd sit down on the bed. She'd say, I'm so disappointed in you. Why don't you just cut my heart out? You know? Just kill me. I'm so disappointed in you. But she would always work it back around to what we were going to do to work through this and how things were going to be better and tomorrow it was going to be a new day. And at the end of it, there would be tears. And then there would be usually some prayer and a pledge and a hug and love and things like this. And then everything was great. This is where I developed my dislike for the big meeting. because this was where I first encountered the dynamics. Do you know what the big meeting is? Some of you have heard me talk about it. I don't like big meetings. Big meetings are where you get a group of people together. We used to do it on youth trips all the time. We get a group of kids together and we take them off somewhere on a mission trip or whatever we were doing. And after about 3 days, they start to snipe at one another and everybody gets crossways. And then the adults get involved in it and everybody chooses up sides. And now everybody's mad. And everybody's, you know, you had couples that started out, you know, this guy was dating this girl. And by the end of it, they're not. And they've switched couples around. And now one of them's not dating there. And then they hate each other because they dated somebody else or did something else. It's just all of that you know, teenage junk that's just so horrible. And then, so what do you do at the end of it? We just need to all get together and we need to share our thoughts and our feelings. And we need to pray and we need to sing and we need to forgive. And so we'd have the big meeting and we'd do all of that. And it was just this big venting of drama and all this stuff. And I just hate that. I hate it. That's why I quit doing youth trips. That's why I won't go see dramatic shows. I don't like drama. This is why. If I want this, all I have to do is show up at work every day. You know what I'm saying? And all of that was just so, it's all kind of manufactured drama. Really not necessary drama. Necessary drama, I deal with that. Comes out of the circumstances of life. Manufactured drama, that's just drawing attention to me. And I don't like that. I don't like the big meetings. But it started a long time ago. That's what we think of when we think of discipline. Do you know what discipline really is? Discipline is today you're going to go to small group afterwards. I am. I wasn't planning on it. Well, plans just changed, right? And so you're going to go to small group and you're going to look around the room and you're going to say, where's so-and-so? I haven't seen them. This week later on, maybe you bump into them, or maybe you call them, or maybe you deliberately and intentionally recognize they've been gone for a few weeks, and you give them a buzz, or you drop them a text, and you say, hey, what's up? I missed you today at small group. That's church discipline. Church discipline is when you have an established relationship with a brother or sister in the Lord, and you go to them and you share with them the struggle that you're having and you ask them to pray for you. Church discipline is where you blow your cork at home because of whatever it is that has built up and the circumstances, and you call your best friend and you say, I need you to pray for me. This just happened and I made such a mess of it, and I just need to process it and I need to talk about it so that I can go back and fix it, and we can work together and we can get on with whatever it is that's before us right now. That's church discipline. Yes, on rare occasions, church discipline takes a more mercenary form, but only as a last resort and only on rare occasions that in my 30 years of pastorate I can count on one hand. Now, should it be more? It should be. But one of the reasons it isn't is because we don't have the kind of connections that we need to build the trust levels that are necessary in order to accomplish the sort of encouragement that we're talking about. Can a church covenant do that? No, of course not. But it can help guide it. And it can give some weight and importance to it. Ultimately, it must be a biblical standard. I was supposed to do another, 20 or 30 minutes of preaching, and I'm not anywhere close to having time to do that. So we're going to have to quit. And I'm going to have to come back to this subject next week in a better way. Here's what I'm going to do. I don't want to cut you off on this covenant conversation. I just looked down and saw the time. I kind of got lost. Church covenants, promise, commitments, they're a way for us to express our devotion to one another, but also our sense of accountability within the church family, biblical in nature, and the intention is to help guide us and encourage us so that we build and develop closer relationships within the church family and the kind of relationships that have trust, so that we can deal with not only how to grow in Christ, but what we do with one another when we don't, or when we fail, or when we mess up. how we can have a sense of trust to know that a church family is not someone that's going to turn on you or someone that's going to gossip about you or someone that's not going to be willing to bear your burden along the way. These are the kinds of things that our desire was to come out of this, and that the covenant would be a means to kind of define that. We haven't got there yet. That's what I'm telling you. We haven't gotten there yet. So here's what we'll do. We'll come back next week, and next week we'll talk about how we get there. How's that? And what's going to be included in that. I thought I could do some of that today, but I don't know what happened. The time just flat disappeared. Does this make sense to you? I can't tell from looking at you. Is it resonating a little bit? Are you comfortable with us having this conversation for another week? Are you okay? Is there anybody here that's absolutely so freaked out and upset that they cannot wait to get out of the building? And if so, would you admit it? I hope that if that is the case, that you'd come talk to me. At least give me a chance to help understanding prevail. My desire isn't for anything other than a deeper and more abiding relationship within the church family that can enable, support, and guide our growth together. I don't want us to expand and be broad and wide like a lake that's only 3 inches deep. I want us to have depth, and that comes through these relationships, and relationships are messy and difficult. And that's okay. That's okay. What do you do at home when things come apart? Well, you fix them. And what if you can't fix them? You're still family. You're still family. That's true of an earthly experience. How much more is that true of an eternal one?